We go to the oral arguments Tuesday in two cases challenging Biden's student debt forgiveness program. Stay with us. Chicago's own Charles Stepney. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The Supreme Court heard oral arguments Tuesday in two challenges to the Biden administration's student debt relief plan, which could give tens of millions of federal borrowers up to $20,000 of relief each. Outside the court, activists rallied.
These lawsuits are bogus, literally backed by right-wing billionaires. Look it up. Rich people who've happily accepted government handouts in the form of having their PPP loans forgiven or receiving government subsidies. Does the government work for them or does it work for us? That's my question. Okay, so if you ask me now what it feels like to be $120,000 in student loan debt, I say it feels like solidarity. It feels like power. If one person owes the bank, that's not one person's problem. But when a million people owe the bank, that's the bank's problem.
That's Maddie Clifford of the Debt Collective. Supporters of student debt relief were joined by lawmakers, including independent Senator Bernie Sanders, who called education a human right and said public colleges and universities should be tuition free.
In America, you should not have to face financial ruin because you want a damn education.
Inside the Supreme Court, several conservative justices expressed skepticism over the Biden student debt relief plan, while liberal Justice Sonia Sotomayor blasted the Republican states who brought one of the suits.
There's 50 million students who are will benefit from this, who today will struggle. Many of them don't have assets sufficient to bail them out after the pandemic. They don't have friends or families or others who can help them make these payments. The evidence is clear that many of them will have to default. Their financial situation will be even worse because once you default, the hardship on you is exponentially greater. You can't get credit. You're going to pay higher prices for things. They are going to continue to suffer from this pandemic in a way that the general population doesn't. And what you're saying is, now we're going to give judges the right to decide how much aid to give them.
That's Justice Sonia Sotomayor Tuesday. Before we're joined by our next guest, I want to play a clip from a video produced by a More Perfect Union about a group funding the lawsuits against student debt relief called the Jobs Creators Network.
The same billionaires and corporations that don't want you to have higher wages, that want to bust your unions, that don't want you to have decent and free medical care, that want to dictate what you do with your body, that want more tax cuts for the super rich, they're the ones that also want you to stay neck deep in student debt.
For more on all of this, we're joined by Eleni Shermer. She organizes with the Debt Collective. She's a writer and postdoctoral fellow at Concordia University's Social Justice Center in Montreal. Her new piece in The New Yorker is headlined How the Government Canceled Betty Ann's Debts and follows up on her piece last summer, The Aging Student Debtors of America. In an era of declining wages and rising debt, Americans are not aging out of their student loans. They are aging into them. Well, Eleni, welcome to Democracy Now! Why don't you start off by laying out the arguments and the cases before the Supreme Court yesterday and the questions that were asked by the Supreme Court justices?
Yeah, thanks so much. Thanks for having me here. I just want to start by saying we shouldn't take for granted the fact that 5 years ago, 10 years ago, the fact that calling for student debt cancellation was wildly ludicrous. And yesterday, we saw the Solicitor General representing the Department of Justice and the Biden administration arguing tooth and nail for the right for these loans to be canceled and the necessity for these loans to be canceled. So that's just the big picture framing of what happened yesterday, is that we even got to this point is just a fundamental testament to the strength of the movement. Yesterday, what happened at the Supreme Court was that they were hearing two cases. One was brought by six Republican attorney generals who were suing the Biden administration because of the claim that entities in their states will lose money if student debt debts become canceled. The other one was brought by two plaintiffs from Texas who are suing the program because they believe they were either excluded from getting relief or not getting the full amount of relief. So instead of petitioning to expand and increase the debt relief program, they were suing to halt the whole thing.
And could you talk about the this issue of that you wrote about in one in a New Yorker piece, the aging student debtors of America, that you highlight the astonishing fact that there's a growing demographic of student debtors that are people over the age of 60?
Yeah, this is, I mean, I, as someone who's working in this student debt space, I'm familiar with the understanding of debt as a poverty tax. The people who have the least money end up paying the most. This is how debt functions, basically. But it was really a revelation for me when I understood that people, the fastest growing demographic of student debtors are old people. And it really sort of shed light on the absolute policy failure of student debt, that once you take on a loan, it becomes increasingly harder and harder to get out of it. We saw this, you know, one of the people that I was lucky enough to listen to her story was a 91-year-old woman named Betty Ann, who was worked as a school teacher in Harlem for decades, and at age 55 decided to go back to school. She wanted a different tool, a different angle on the problems that she was seeing around her. She decided to go to law school in the 80s. At this point, she was one of the first black women to attend New York University Law School. And to do this, she had to borrow about $30,000 in the mid-80s. When I spoke to her in 2022, she owed more than $300,000 in debt. And this is just sort of, she's one of thousands of people who have paid, made years and years and years of payments only to find their balances continue to grow, that the administrative errors on the Department of Education has put her in worse case, and that it's, she, when I spoke to her, she was preparing to die with those loans. At 91 years old, it's hard to imagine how she's going to come up with $330,000 to pay back debt. And this is unfortunately all too common as we talk to people who unfortunately believe that their only way out of their debt is by coffin.
And her grandson, Jeremy Flood?
That's right. And her grandson, I mean, it's an intergenerational problem. We see Betty has debt. Her grandson has debt. He's one of the millions of people who applied for relief under President Biden's proposed program this summer to cancel $10,000 to $20,000 per debtor of relief. And he, along with, you know, millions right now, is waiting to find out what's going to happen, if he's going to be able to, you know, have enough money to begin to make other plans with his life, to start a family, to invest in a house, to save for retirement. These are the kinds of questions that rest on this policy. What will people be able to do with the rest of their lives?
And when you mentioned Biden's announcement last year, the you've raised a point that the administration made a mistake in not having an application to apply for debt relief ready at the very time that they made the announcement. Could you talk about that?
Right. So, you know, probably the first mistake actually was from my point of view and my colleague's point of view, was needing an application to begin with. It wasn't, there were proposals that were floated prior to Biden for debt to be automatically and universally eliminated, which would mean that everybody who has student debt would get their debt canceled. This was not the path that President Biden took. Although, you know, there was a whole, the weeks before the Biden's announcement, basically every group representing civil society, labor unions, the NAACP, advocacy groups, attorney generals were pushing the Biden administration to cancel this debt automatically and universally. And the Biden administration, for unclear reasons, chose not to take that path. They wanted to implement the relief with means testing to make sure that the right debtors were getting relief. And by right, they were trying to peg it at a certain income threshold. So they picked the number of $125,000. If you make it $125,000 or less, you're eligible for $10,000 to $20,000 of relief. This was the program that they announced at the end of August. But also, for unclear reasons, upon announcing this program, they did not have an application ready to go, fired, for people to fill out. And it took almost 6 weeks for an application to become ready. They rolled out this application on a Friday afternoon, which, you know, as in the news world or the, you know, that's a bad time to roll out anything, a Friday afternoon. But within hours, millions of people had applied. And what's more, the people who applied were from some of the poorest places in the country, right? This new analysis of those who applied for relief, the average per capita income of the person who applied for relief is less than $35,000. So there's this sort of notion that debt relief, canceling student debt, is a giveaway to the wealthy. Most people who applied for student debt relief are making under $35,000 a year. But so back to the question about the delay in between, in those 6 weeks between President Biden's announcement of the policy and actually rolling out the application, that was a fatal 6 weeks. In that time, half a dozen right-wing lawsuits were filed to challenge the entire program. And four of these suits have been dismissed, but two of them played the game very strategically, and they were able to find plaintiffs and that were going to advance the claims to halt the whole program. And more importantly, they were able to find sympathetic Republican Trump-appointed judges who were willing to hear what a lot of legal experts consider to be just laughable claims to bring a suit, which in legal terms is called to have standing. So that's sort of the moment that's how we got to this moment right now.
I want to go to Chief Justice John Roberts speaking during the oral arguments for the Department of Education versus Myra Brown.
Since we're dealing in a case with individual borrowers or would-be borrowers, I think it appropriate to consider some of the fairness arguments. You know, you have two situations. Both two kids come out of high school. They can't afford college. One takes a loan. And the other says, well, I'm going to, you know, try my hand at setting up a lawn care service. And he takes out a bank loan for that. At the end of 4 years, we know statistically that the person with the college degree is going to do significantly financially better over the course of life than the person without. And then along comes the government and tells that person, you don't have to pay your loan. Nobody's telling the person who is trying to set up the lawn service business that he doesn't have to pay his loan. He still does, even though his tax dollars are going to support the forgiveness of the loan for the college graduate who's now going to make a lot more than him over the course of his lifetime.
So that was Chief Justice John Roberts. Interestingly, the federal government has in fact forgiven loans for lawn care companies and many other types of companies. According to federal records, a company called Tough Lawn Service in Norwalk, Connecticut, had a $358,760 loan forgiven for money it received through the PPP, Paycheck Protection Program. And that's only one example. So if you could address this, Eleni, and also overall, I mean, there's very few people who object to the GI Bill, where so many people who served in various wartime situations went to college, and that was considered a very good thing, supported by the federal government. Is it that over time, the color, the complexion of the borrowers has changed, and that's why there are questions being asked right now?
I mean, I think that's a really important question. I don't think it's a massive coincidence that the same session that the Supreme Court is hearing the cases about student debt relief, they will also potentially bring an end to race-conscious admissions and affirmative action programs and higher education admissions. So the question of who will be able to go to college and what financial burdens will follow them is really central to the Supreme Court's session right now. You know, as to the issue of fairness, this, you know, what would be I found this to be a humorous part of the exchange yesterday. As the claims around what's fair, it would be fair if college was free for everybody, so we didn't have to try to pit one struggling worker against another struggling worker and who's making the better gamble of how to make their way to health insurance, to a job that will provide health insurance, a job that maybe will provide some sick time if they get ill. I mean, these are the kinds of questions when people decide to go to college. They're not generally trying to, this isn't a get-rich-quick scheme. This is a chance to try to figure out, how can I contribute to my society? How can I provide for myself? What's going to be my path to be able to have a meaningful wage that gives me a little bit of job protections? And right now, you know, the decline of the labor movement, the erosion of labor rights, has basically routed that path through higher education. If we had it, we could have a very different situations for how people could get access to dignified wages, to secure jobs that provided health insurance, pensions, benefits. We didn't set up this is not the economy that we're living under. We route that, those kinds of social welfare provisions. I'm in Canada right now, and you don't need to go to college to get health care here in Canada. This is a perfectly, there could be other arrangements on the table. That's not what we're working with. So,
Eleni, I wanted to ask you, Eleni, we just have about 30 seconds, but I just want to ask you one other question. The reference of Chief Justice Roberts in that clip that we just played to getting a college education, graduating from a four-year college, do we have any data on the percentage of these loans that are basically, you know, these fly-by-night for-profit schools that, for everything from beautician programs, promising the students a career that never panned out or that they never graduated from college? What percentage of the loans are represented by that those kinds of outcomes?
A vast majority of the people who have student debt never graduated from their programs. So I think, you know, that's an important thing to consider. The fairness question that Justice Roberts is pointing out implies that people are making a lot of money off of their degree. And we know that's actually just not true. A lot of people actually aren't even able to finish their program, perhaps because they have to, the cost of tuition is so high or the debt loads are so high, they have to take on other jobs to be able to pay for education to begin with. So I think, you know, the point here, what's fair is for the government, who has the power to create these loans to begin with, has the power to cancel them if they so choose to, which is the basis of President Biden's relief program.
Eleni Shermer, we want to thank you for being with us, writer and postdoctoral fellow at Concordia University Social Justice Center in Montreal, organizes with the Debt Collective. We'll link to your piece in The New Yorker, How the Government Canceled Betty Ann's Debts and the Aging Student Debtors of America. Next up, we go to Alabama, where hundreds of striking minors are returning to work at the Warrior Met Coal Company after nearly 2 years, back in less than 30 seconds.
Keep your pity to yourself, basking in megawatts of wealth. Think nothing of the blood that beats that wire. See me work there on the news, enduring endless interviews, while I wait here for the glare to expire.
And those men in Washington, they cry that something must be done for those poor old souls to keep us safe and well. Overhead in private jets, they ain't done nothing for us yet as we toil in a black and sooty hell. I hear workers overhead trying to reach us forward.
Coal Miner's Song by the Poxy Boggards. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we end today's show in Alabama, where hundreds of striking miners are set to return to work Thursday at the Warrior Met Coal Company after nearly 2 years on the picket line. The president of the United Mine Workers of America sent a letter to Warrior Met granting an unconditional offer to return to work on March 2nd as the two parties continue to negotiate a new contract. For more on the end of the longest strike in the history of Alabama, a so-called right-to-work state with powerful anti-union laws, we're joined in Birmingham by Kim Kelly, independent labor journalist who's covered the Warrior Met strike since it began. Her new piece for The Nation magazine is headlined, Why the Warrior Met Strike is Ending. She's also author of the book Fight Like Hell, The Untold History of American Labor. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Kim. It's great to have you with us. Explain what's happening tomorrow and the significance of this longest strike in Alabama history.
Thank you so much for having me and for spotlighting these workers' struggle. It's been difficult to get media attention on this strike. But yes, after 23 months, the coal miners of Brookwood, Alabama are heading back to work. Now, March 2nd is the return to work date that President Cecil Roberts gave. It's going to be a long process, though. The company, I acquired a document from the company that expressed some of the conditions that it had for the workers to return. It wants them to get physicals and drug tests and undergo safety training. So it's not all going to happen at once. Not everyone is going to roll down into the mines tomorrow, but the process has begun. And this is in kind of a messy end to what's been a very long and grueling and difficult labor conflict down here in outside Birmingham, Alabama. These miners went on strike back in April 1st, 2021. They voted down a tentative agreement that was reached a few days later. I believe that was April 8th or 9th, and they've been out on strike ever since. It has been a slog, but these miners have held the line. You know, they've been supported by their families, by the local community. It's been incredibly difficult because, as you mentioned, Alabama's a right-to-work state. This is not a union-friendly area. The local judiciary has made it incredibly difficult for them to hold their pickets and to continue the strike. Local law enforcement has made it very clear they are not on the workers' side. The company's been very recalcitrant in the way that it's dealt with the strike. But after 23 months, the decision was made by UMWA leadership that, you know, they had to try a new tactic. The company has not been budging. The company has actually been profiting, even with the skeleton crew of scabs it has been operating with, due to high coal prices. So it's really at kind of a do-or-die point. As President Roberts mentioned in the letter he sent to Warrior Met's CEO, the only people being harmed right now are the miners and their families. And so the union has changed tack, and the strike itself is no longer happening. But the fight continues. They're going to keep fighting out this struggle in negotiations at the bargaining table. And hopefully we're going to finally see some movement, because these miners really need a break right now.
And could you talk about the company's use of replacement workers and the impact that that had and in their ability to persevere against the union in this case?
Absolutely. One of the reasons that Warrior Met Coal has been able to remain profitable and productive is the fact that it launched an extensive effort to recruit replacement workers, scabs, from other states. We've seen billboards as far as West Virginia and Kentucky, Tennessee, asking workers, come down here, come work for us, we'll give you benefits, we'll give you bonuses. The people working in the mines right now who are not union, who are replacement workers, they're making $2,000 a month bonuses that the workers whose jobs those rightfully are were never making. And it's a problem because these workers, they don't have the experience and the knowledge that the union miners have. You know, some of these folks are new to mining. They've worked 9 months, a year. Some of the folks that are on strike, they've been working in those mines for 20, 30 years. That makes a difference. And the company's been able to exploit the fact that workers need to pay the bills. Coal mining is a complicated industry. There aren't as many decent paying jobs as there used to be. And so people have come down from other states and essentially taken these Alabama workers' jobs, crossed the picket line, and helped to break this strike.
As you write about, Warrior Met reported large profits due to the mines running the skyrocketing price of coal. Can you talk about not only this and what that means, but also what it means to be in Alabama, a famously anti-labor state, and what this signifies for the country right now?
So much of this is sheer bad luck. The miners walked out on April 1st. In June 2021, coal prices skyrocketed. I believe they quadrupled, and that those prices have held. So throughout the entire strike, or even though these workers have been out, they have been running a skeleton crew, the mines have not been at full capacity, the owners have been able to profit because of those coal prices. And the market is not something that workers can control. So it's been a huge issue and a huge reason why the strike's economic impact hasn't been felt the way that the union and the workers wanted it to be. And also the fact that we are in Alabama, which I must say is a state with an incredibly rich labor history and a strong labor movement, but a very, very anti-union state government. It's a right-to-work state, which weakens the movement. As I mentioned, law enforcement has been very clear about whose side they're on in this conflict, and have turned a blind eye to violence on the picket line. And Alabama itself, there's something that happens a lot when we talk about the Deep South, places like Alabama and Mississippi and Louisiana, where I think there's an impulse for folks to write them off. It's like, okay, well, we're not going to be able to pull anything off here anyway. There's no point. But there is, and there are so many people who have been fighting here for centuries, whether we're talking about the mine mill workers decades ago, or the sharecroppers that Robin D.G. Kelley highlighted in his book Hammer and Hoe, or the Amazon workers down the street in Bessemer 2 years ago that launched the first effort to unionize an Amazon warehouse in this country. There is a labor movement here. There are workers here, but they need more support. They need better laws. They need better politicians and officials to actually support them, because this shows what happens when workers are abandoned by the people that are supposed to advocate for them and supposed to protect them. They're hung out to dry and left at the mercy of a Wall Street venture capital-backed company that sees nothing but dollar signs when it looks at them.
And we've only got about a minute left, but I wanted to ask you precisely about the lack of support, either focusing on this strike by the national media or national politicians, especially given the fact that the Biden administration claims to be so pro-labor. There were no major political figures coming to Alabama to walk the picket line or focus on the strike.
The workers here have felt abandoned, and basically the issue with this strike is that these are a group of multiracial, multigender, rural, blue-collar union workers in Alabama. The Republicans know that they're union, so they don't care about them, and Democrats see them as a lost cause because many of them are conservative. It's a more culturally and politically conservative group of workers, so they think, oh, well, it's not worth our time. But they are. This should have been the biggest labor story in the country for the past 2 years, and it wasn't. And I think that says a lot about the biases and prejudices and partisan nonsense that dictate whose stories get covered and whose don't.
Kim, we just have 20 seconds, but the issue of conversion, moving away from coal, and how workers are included in that discussion.
Yeah, that is a big question for 20 seconds. But one thing I want to mention about these workers specifically, they mine metallurgical coal, which is not involved in the energy economy. It's used to make steel. If we went to a green economy tomorrow, these workers would still be heading down into the pits, and that coal, that met coal, would still be shipped overseas to industrialized countries. It's complicated, but the thing I want to impress listeners with is that we need to look after workers even if we don't like the jobs they're doing. Solidarity means solidarity. And we need to work this out together as we move forward, because we can't afford to leave people behind.
Kim Kelley, want to thank you so much for being with us, independent labor journalist. We're going to link to your piece in The Nation, Why the Warrior Met Strike is Ending, her book, Fight Like Hell. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Wandering Rhythms, Mondays from noon to two.
Join us in a weekly sample of music from planet Earth.
The strangest mixtape you will ever hear.
Desert blues.
Balkan punk.
Latin funk.
African psych.
Pigeon rap.
And anything and everything else you can imagine, equally represented by all continents.
Because good music is universal.
Wandering Rhythms.
Mondays at noon on CJSF 90.1 FM.